Now, it's a great pleasure to speak with Paul Jones. Thanks so much for being on the show, Paul.
Pleasure, Suzanne. Thank
now, any fans of blues music and the music of the Manfreds will know what a unique voice and stage presence you have. But, you know, you could have been singing with Keith Richards as their lead singer. Tell us about that.
Yes, I could have, I suppose. Well, what happened was I was Brian Jones and I were quite good friends in 1962. And he lived in Cheltenham, I lived in Oxford, and we used to go every Saturday night to Alexis Corner's Club in Ealing, the home of British rhythm and blues, you might say, and so did everybody else. But one day, Brian and I sort of gigged a bit together, usually at parties and unpaid, and one day he rang me up and he said, look, we're not taking this thing seriously enough. I'm going to move to London, I'm going to get a flat there, I'm starting a band, and I'm going to become very rich and very famous. Would you like to be my singer? And I said no.
Oh, that was an offer you couldn't refuse there.
Well, the thing was, I had two real reasons, I suppose. I said, Brian, you know, I'm very impressed with your determination, but this music that we play, this blues, it's really only niche music, and no one's ever going to get really rich doing it. Ha, ha, ha. And the second thing was I just got myself a job singing with a dance band in Slough, and the manager of this place and band said to me, you take this job, and I promise you that I'll get you an audition with the biggest agency in Britain. I took the job, and the audition with the agency never materialized. So I was not in Brian Jones's band, which of course did become the Rolling Stones, nor had I got this audition. So the next time somebody said, we're starting a band and would you like to be the singer, I said yes, and that was the Manfreds.
Oh, well, you made the right choice there, didn't you?
Well, I did. I mean, actually, I think I made the right choice in the first place because the truth is, if I had joined Brian in that band, it never would have become what we now know as the Rolling Stones. I mean, whatever it had been called, whatever Mick Jagger and Keith Richards did, that would have become what we now know as the Rolling Stones. And I may well have been right about, you know, not making money out of what Brian and I did. But anyway,
it's all water under the bridge now.
All speculative. And
exactly. You never know these things.
And who cares? Anyway,
exactly.
I'm very happy with the career I'm having.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's phenomenal. I mean, what was it about the music of Manfred Mann's band that made you want to be their original frontman?
Well, first of all, they didn't have a band until I joined it. Well, they did. They had a jazz quartet. And although I was very enthusiastic and I liked jazz very much, it wasn't really until I got working with them that they started to play rhythm and blues, because they didn't know anything about it. I mean, they really just wanted to start a rhythm and blues band because Alexis Corner had and seemed to be doing very well with it. Mm. And they were, and you know, Alexis Corner was providing a living for jazz musicians who otherwise might have struggled.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Manfred and Mike Hug were definitely struggling. And they thought, oh, you know, what we'll do is we'll compromise. We'll do one of these rhythm and blues bands. And a man representing them rang me up and said, did I know who they were? And I said, well, I've heard of Manfred because he writes a column in jazz. What was it called? Jazz News, I think. It was a small magazine. And he said, yes, that's the bloke. And I said, well, I know about him, but I don't really know much about his music. And they said, well, they're starting a rhythm and blues band, and they need a shouter. By that, I knew they were jazz musicians, because the term shouter used of a vocalist was really only in use among big bands and those of a jazz nature.
Mm. Wow, Phenomenal. And that's where it all started, of course. I mean, you really were at the forefront of the 60s pop revolution with millions of record sales, and you co-composed the signature tune for Ready, Steady, Go. How did it feel to have such staggering success?
Well, it was, you know, the success came gradually. It wasn't an overnight thing at all. We'd sort of been going for a year before we had our first hit. But what was kind of gratifying was that live, we were always, we were a success from the very beginning, because the little, relatively small places that we played were always full, and you know, full of very, very enthusiastic people. So the success was kind of early in the terms of live performing, but it was a whole year after the band started that somebody from, I think it was called Rediffusion Television in those days, got in touch with us and said, we'd like you to write us a signature tune for this program on television called Ready, Steady, Go. And they told us what they wanted. They wanted a countdown. They wanted such and such a proportion of instrumental before the vocal started and all that sort of thing. And so we went away and wrote this song relatively quickly and easily, actually. We did it in the van going to the gigs.
Perfect.
And came back with it, and they said, that'll do very nicely. And so that became not only the signature tune of Ready, Steady, Go, but it became our first hit, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, it was called.
And, yeah.
Well, I was, I mean, as happy as I was with the way things were already going in terms of live performance, when our manager rang me on a Monday morning and said, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 has come into the charts. They had a top 30 in the New Musical Express in those days, and it had come in at number 29. And I was so excited. I travelled to our regular Monday night gig that night in a taxi, whereas previously I'd always gone by bus.
Yeah, sign of things to come, going up in the world.
Yes, that's right.
Fantastic. Yeah. Oh, I love 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. But also I love all of your hits, really. Do I Diddy. So much of the music on the Five Faces of Manfred Mann album as well. And I understand you share the lead with Mike Darbo in the Manfreds, along with most of the original members of Manfred Mann. Do you have a favourite Manfred Mann song that you've sung on? And do you still enjoy singing any of them in particular when you're on tour with the Manfreds?
Yes, well, I need to say this first of all about Mike Darbo. He's taken a step downwards or outwards at the moment. He's relocating. I think he's probably moving back to America. He lived in America for quite a while in the 70s, and he's going back to America now. So he's not going to be, in fact, he hasn't been with us for most of 2013. We've been touring without him. We did the Five Faces tour without Mike. Well, that was reasonable enough because he wasn't on the original album anyway. But he's not completely left. He's with us again when we do our major sort of biennial tour. So he'll be doing the big tour at the end of 2014. And also he does kind of festivals and things when those turn up in the date sheet. So he's kind of half with us and half not at the moment. As far as favorites are concerned, I still do like the aforementioned 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, daft as it is. Very few people spot the deliberate mistake, which is quite funny. In fact, mm-hmm. Almost nobody has ever spotted the deliberate mistake in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Ooh, that's a challenge.
I hope that perhaps one or two of your listeners will have a quick listen to it and tell you what it is, but I'm not going to.
You've got to discover it for yourself.
I do like that one very, very much indeed. Yeah. Another favourite of mine is a song called Oh No, Not My Baby, which was by no means our biggest hit, but it's a personal favourite.
Yeah, that's lovely. I love that one. I was just playing that a moment ago, actually. So, yes, right. We'll have that on the show. Now, as well as your great voice, another talent that's always stood out for me is your exceptional harmonica playing. Now, as someone who's in the first throes of learning the harmonica, I have to say I've got a long way to go to get to your standard. But how long did it take you to learn, and who inspired you to play?
Well, the harmonica is no different from any other instrument in one respect, and that is that when you first try to play it, it's impossibly difficult.
Yes, definitely.
And then when you sort of, you kind of have these breakthrough moments. And it's the same with any instrument, really. You when you first learn to do something, you go, wow, I can play. And, of course, you can't yet, but at least you can do much more things that you couldn't do yesterday or last week. Yes. And then, after you've gone a little way further on, it becomes impossibly difficult again. And it goes in waves like that, I think. So when you ask somebody, when did you first learn to play? I mean, the thing is, I'm still learning. I took it up in 1962, and I was playing it with the Manfreds in 1963. So it was less than a year, I suppose. I was able to play publicly in less than a year. But really, I haven't been playing and to a point that I think I'm sort of really any good until comparatively recently, really, a few years ago.
Well, I think you're fantastic.
A few years ago. I mean, the blues band's been going for 34 years now. We started in 1979.
Yeah.
And I suppose somewhere along the line with the blues band, I reached a level where at least I was kind of reasonably happy with it. But I've been improving.
Well, you certainly have. I mean, you're currently the president of the National Harmonica League, which I'm sure they don't give out lightly. And you're awarded Harmonica Player of the Year in the British Blues Awards of 2010-2011. So I think I'll
and
leave
12.
The... And 12. Fantastic.
Yep. And which meant that this year I wasn't eligible to be voted for, because you win 3 years or 3 years in a row, and you get kicked upstairs into the House of Lords, or rather what they call the Golden Greats or something.
Yes.
Whatever it is.
Yes, exactly.
But you can't be voted for again after that.
Oh, that's a shame. 3 times. We think you're fantastic anyway. I mean, I'd give you an award this year. I mean, you clearly love rhythm and blues. I mean, who doesn't? But you've enjoyed a parallel career as a presenter, DJ, critic, and you also present a radio show focusing on rhythm and blues that's on Radio 2, and you've celebrated 25 years in 2011, so congratulations.
But
what made you want to step off stage?
27 and rising now.
27 and rising.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Where does the time go?
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I still think I'm 35, you know.
We're not going to tell anyone. Now, of course, I mean, it's fantastic to do that job, isn't it? But you stepped away from the stage, didn't you?
I really like working there. And the thought that, you know, every week, for an hour, I can share what I've been listening to for the last week with, my goodness, not far short of a million people. And that's only in this country. I mean, you know, people listening online all over the place as well.
I bet the States love it, don't they, as well in America. I bet they love your show.
Yeah, I got regular listeners in America. Yeah.
Fantastic. I mean... on another subject, I understand you contributed a set of questions on the programme Mastermind. What questions did you offer?
Oh, well, somebody had gone on there, and his special subject was blues harmonica players, or blues harmonica playing. And they said, you'll have to narrow that. So he narrowed it to a particular period. And they rang me up and they said, this guy wants questions on that topic during this period, and you have to make them you have to make them at sort of three definitions of difficulty: the easy, medium, and difficult. And so I did exactly as I was asked, and the guy didn't win.
Oh, you were just far too tricky, weren't you? Very, very specialist.
I wasn't, you know, I mean, obviously, I would have loved him to win. But actually, he didn't know. I don't think he knew quite as much as he thought he did.
Well, that's the thing. You've got to really know your stuff, haven't you? Very specialist.
Yeah.
I mean, you've always had great presence on stage as a singer. So did it seem a natural progression to move to acting?
Well, no, I don't think it was a natural progression at all. I never liked acting. When I was at school, I always used to try and get out of being in the school play.
Even in the nativity.
Or if I had to be in it, at least to get a small part. I really didn't like the idea of it at all, or the idea of doing it myself at all. But I was always quite sort of keen on other people doing it. And so I used to like watching movies and even going to the theatre as well. And so when Peter Watkins, who was a film director that I admired on the basis of really two bits of work that he had done, got in touch with me and asked if I would like to be in a film called Privilege, I went for it, but really on the basis that I admired him, not on the basis that I wanted to be an actor. And although, I guess, you know, you are being watched doing something, that's about where the similarities end, really, I think, because acting and singing are really quite different from each other.
Yes. I mean, you're acting a song, aren't you?
When you act in a musical, then you are kind of combining the two things, and to that extent, I think that obviously they're much closer together than say doing a gig with the blues band and acting in a straight play. There's very little in common between those two things. Although I suppose, to some extent, you're acting a song. I'm thinking out loud, really, at the moment, because I've never really thought much about this. But it wasn't until I started to do musicals, which is long after I started acting, that I began to really take my voice seriously. I never had any lessons. Actually, that's not true. I did go to a teacher once because I had really terrible vocal problems. This was really just after I left the Manfreds, back in, you know, the mid-60s. And I had terrible problems. And I did go to a singing teacher, briefly, really. But it wasn't until I started doing musicals when did I do my first one? About 1973, something like that. Having started acting in 1966, I then began to, because you have to do 8 performances a week, 6 nights and 2 matinees, your voice really does take a caning. And so that was the point at which I decided I really had to start taking my voice seriously and getting some tuition and coaching and stuff, and so I did.
Yes, but, it's very intense, isn't it, in musical theatre, isn't
that's
it?
That topic.
Yeah,
we played. Overreacted to.
Well, no, you played the title role, didn't you, of Pippin, and you also played the lead role like Perron on the original concept album. So that must have been, you know, for Andrew Lloyd Webber, that must have been very exciting to sort of be in part of that, really.
Yes, well, I always actually liked Tim Rice's lyrics and him as a person. I didn't really know Andrew quite as well as I knew Tim. But nonetheless, I mean, obviously, anything that two extremely successful people ask you to join in on is a great idea.
Yes, definitely.
So I've jumped into the Perron situation with great enthusiasm.
Fabulous roles, aren't they?
Well, when it came to casting the stage play, the producers said, no, you're too young. Perron has to be older.
Well, yeah, it's true, isn't it, really, I suppose, yes. And, well, producers have very different ideas on things, don't they? Stage to screen and albums, they always change, don't they?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
But, I mean, you actually, I mean, going from musicals to blues, I mean, you're out on tour with the band you set up, as you said, in 1979. And obviously that idea was to bring blues music to the world. And it must have, you know, kick-started a real boom in blues music, which is very great, isn't it? And I believe you recorded about 17 albums with them.
Yes, I think we're up to, I think we might be up to about 19 now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got up to
I kind of lose contact or count because, for instance, the latest release by the blues band is actually a DVD and CD of a television performance in April 1980.
Oh, right.
Which has never come out in that form.
Mm.
Obviously, it came out as a broadcast. And it was part of a program called Rock Palast, which was international. It was made in Germany over a period of years from the late 70s to, I can't remember. In fact, I'm not sure that it isn't still going or resumed going. Mm-hmm. But our performance on it was in 1980. And somehow, actually, we're with a German record company now called Repertoire. And I guess they had a better idea of how to persuade Rock Palast to part with some of its files or archives.
Yes, exactly.
And out has come this blues band thing. Well, that never counted as one of our albums, but obviously it now has. And I think it might be album number 20.
Aww.
But I'm not sure.
Yes. And what's the name of that one, Paul?
I think it's just called Live at Rock Palast.
Oh, like. Well, that would make sense.
Yes, that's right, yes. The blues band Live at Rock Palast.
Oh, I should check that one out.
They've put out a few others as well. I know that they've done Alvin Lee and 10 Years Later, not 10 Years After, 10 Years Later. That was a band that he formed quite later on.
Yes.
I know Climax Blues Band have got one there. And Mickey Jupp, the great Essex songwriter.
Got quite a wide variety of artists there.
Oh,
then.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on the year we did it, ZZ Top, Joan Armour Trading.
Warmer guest. Got a lot of artists.
Maybe that was it.
Yeah. That's quite enough, isn't
there
it?
There probably was at least one other.
Yeah.
Artist, but I can't remember.
Fabulous. Oh, my goodness. Wow. A lot going on. I mean, I bet you're glad to be, you know, back on tour with the blues band, because it sounds really exciting. And you're actually going to be stopping off at the Epsom Playhouse on the 1st of November.
Yes.
So tell us, what can audiences expect from the show?
Well, actually, they can expect a good chunk of the set of the evening to be from the Rock Palast album. Now, actually, there's a lot of people who've been fans of ours for 30 years or more, and they're absolutely delighted by it, because they're songs that we haven't done for years and years and years, and they were the songs that brought people to be our fans for, you know, all those years ago, three decades ago.
Fantastic.
And so that's going down extremely well. Our previous latest album, which is still our latest studio album, is a thing called Few Short Lines, which is a song originally done by, some old blues man. Oh, all right then, Mississippi Fred McDowell.
What a great name.
And, I know three or four songs from that as well. And then the rest will be drawn from our 18 albums before that, or 17, whatever it was.
No one will ever get out of the auditorium.
Well,
just a few from the album.
You know, we'll tighten it up.
Mm-hmm.
We'll enjoy ourselves.
That sounds good.
It's up it's up to anyone else who's bought a ticket to enjoy themselves as well.
Oh, definitely, yes. Get up and have a little blues boogie if you fancy it, or watch the fantastic show. So, I mean, I think it's going to be absolutely excellent, and I wish you lots of success with the tour, and as you stop off to Epsom as well.
Thank you very much for speaking to me, Paul.
Thanks very much for speaking to me.
Thank you.
Now, that was Paul Jones, and he's going to be with the Blues Band at the Epsom Playhouse on the 1st of November, and also on tour. Brooklyn's Radio.